We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show and podcast that brings independent and interesting STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine content, to you from Tasmania. The show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium youth station, so head to edge.org.au to find out more. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palawa and Pakana people, as we record on Lutruwita. As we are a podcast, we would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which you are tuning in from. And on behalf of everyone here, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Dr. Kate Johnson, and I'm joined today by my lovely guest and fellow TWIX team member, Dr. Meredith Castles. And we're actually Meredith's in Tasmania today, but I'm all the way over in Switzerland, and it's really nice to see her face and see a familiar face while we're recording. And Meredith is actually a long-time member of That's What I Call Science, but we haven't had her on for an episode to talk about her work. So a little bit about Meredith before we start. Dr. Meredith Castles works in information technology, often shortened to IT, but she doesn't fix people's computer systems, which is probably the context you've heard IT in if you're someone ignorant like me. Meredith actually works in research. She's a researcher, a very multidisciplinary one, combining science, communication and research. So it's a real pleasure to get to be the one to interview you today, Meredith. And we're just going to start off with a little bit about you. So how did you get to this area? Can you tell us a bit about your journey to this really multidisciplinary area of research?
Thanks, Kate. I love this show. It's amazing. And I'm really, really grateful that you've gotten up early to interview me all the way over in Tasmania. My name is Meredith. I do ICT episodes for TWIX, which has been really awesome. But my area is, I work at the intersection of a few areas, as you mentioned. So ICT isn't fixing computers as such. It is actually breaking them is probably more what we try to do on a regular basis. But I work in human-computer interaction, citizen social science, and science communication. So it's quite a large three areas that are brought together that aren't normally brought together. So human-computer interaction is a field that deals with the design of technology at the interface of where humans and technology actually meet. So that could be something as simple as the interface that you work in. Sometimes you know how broken they can be. that's a fail of HCI. But also it could be looking at psychology and how users actually interact with technology, not necessarily just with their fingers, but how they emotionally react, for example. Citizen social science is using a crowdsourcing approach to being able to solve social problems and phenomena. And science communication, as we all know, is how to actually communicate more complex topics more simply. And that's my three research areas.
Wow, Meredith. Oh my goodness. So many things. That's amazing. And yeah, it's so important in the age of technology where we interact with technology from the moment we wake up to going to bed. And I wonder if you can tell us, because I know, you know, you're both a scientist and an artist. So what was your journey here? What sort of made you think, I really want to combine my loves for these two things? Did you study art? Did you study science? Did you study both?
I studied a little bit of both. So I did some science subjects at uni and everything, but it wasn't a formal science degree or anything like that. I did a Bachelor of Arts. My background is actually in ancient history and English, and communication came from sort of that area because that is it's an old area. So being able to communicate it in a relevant way was actually really important. So I actually started there and then went into healthcare and everything, and being able to communicate. I found in whatever field I was in, I needed to be able to communicate the complex topics. I always found myself in technology. It was just a thing. I never studied technology. I fell into it. But my arts background is in TV and radio, basically. I did over 20 years of acting and directing and writing in TV and radio and film. I've always valued communication, and science communication was just something that fit really well. As it came along, I didn't know it was a field when I started, which was really good. So I as soon as I realized it was a field and I could actually do some good with it, I actually wanted to make that central to everything I was doing. So I just made sure that that was a metric in whatever I was trying to do, basically. And I talked with teaching. I noticed that technology students in particular, and they know this, so it's not an insult, are not very good at communicating, probably more so than a lot of other fields. They're just a little bit more insular, a little bit more, they've grown up that way, essentially, with the, and environmentally, it's, they've shaped their sort of worldview around an online world, in general. This is very generalized. And so I just found that I, yeah, managed to be able to go, I can marry all of these. It hasn't been done, but I'm going to marry all of these, get them involved, by the citizen social science aspect, and then this whole area was born.
Oh, that's so great. So in your current role, I know you interact a lot with these with ICT students. So what sort of things do you do to sort of improve their ability to communicate or involve them in communication activities? What sort of activities?
I found that I had to take an unorthodox approach. So whereas we, as educators, we have to fit within curriculum and educational design, which means that we have to do lectures, tutorials, etc. But what I found is that if you go to where they are, that's the biggest thing. If you go to where they are, they will listen to you, they will interact more when they feel a little bit more safe and secure. So I found them as such. We know where they are. I found them in the online areas. And by doing that, a lot of, when you think of computing, a lot of people think of games. And I found an online platform which was very common among ICT students and ICT enthusiasts called Twitch. And it's a gaming platform. It's a live stream gaming platform. You might have seen sort of images of the gamer on one side, and there's a big game happening and they're screaming and there's explosions. And that's not me, but I do use the platform in order to talk about science concepts, talk about the concepts that might be worrying them, or and we also imparting educational conversations by distracting them with games. It sounds great. We use games to then as metaphors of what they're studying.
Yeah. So what does that look like? Do you choose a game that's popular with the target audience, and then you play the game? But do you send out a link and say, I'm also going to talk about science communication? How do you draw people into these streams?
It's taken a while. It's taken a while, and it's no different than marketing yourself on any other platform like YouTube, for example. So what happens is, in terms of a student situation, obviously I would say, this is the channel, this is when I will be streaming. Come along and see what you think. It's often not what you think. I won't be sitting there going, here is a lecture. That's the worst thing I could possibly do to them. But I may say, hey, game devs or development teams may make games. These could be students. They could be other people just making games. And quite often they'll go to a streamer and go, here is a game, break it for me or play it. Tell me what you think, that sort of thing. So quite a lot of times I can do that. And then my job, what I've created my job out of, is using things that go wrong in the games, things that go right in the games. Sometimes it might be the music track. It could be the art. It could be the programming. It could be anything at all about the game that I can then make a metaphor for, or an alignment with what they're studying. So they're learning. And what we do is we talk. And by talk, what I mean is the only person on a stream you hear is me. That's the audio or anyone I allow into the voice chat. Everyone else, there could be thousands of people. It could be five people. But they will be in a text chat. So it means that they don't have to talk verbally if they don't want to. That's usually the problem. And they can interact in any way that they see fit. But what we're doing is talking about these concepts. I'm not lecturing to anyone. We're having conversations about what they think. And that tends to help them with their units, which is great.
Oh, that's awesome. So do you actually do this in a structured way as part of the courses that you teach as well as, or is this a kind of a side project?
It's a side project for now, but luckily for me, it is starting to get a bit noticed. So as we all know, as science communicators, it's not really a metric for most academic jobs, science communication. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that will change eventually. But for the first time ever, I've got a chance with the job that I'm doing now. I have a chance to introduce science communication, not as part of my units, because unfortunately for with units at any university, it's a set structure. But mm-hmm. it isn't an added, it's an added bonus, unfortunately, for the moment. But I am slowly but surely introducing this as a metric. I'm introducing science communication in any form as a metric for academics, especially in ICT, using the streaming platforms.
That's so important. That's awesome, Meredith. And yeah, a stream of teaching that most academics would not really think of is reaching out to the online community where, like you say, I guess a lot of your target audience are. And that's awesome. So join us for part two, where we talk more about Meredith's research and more about the implications of combining science and art in the way that she does. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. Today, I'm joined by my lovely guest, Dr. Meredith Castles, who works in ICT and has a really unorthodox approach to teaching and engaging with students. Meredith, we've just talked about streaming, all about streaming, but I know for this work and for other work that you've been doing, you've won a couple of awards, which is really exciting. So could you tell us a little bit about those awards and a bit about the body of work that they really acknowledge?
Thank you. So there was a couple of awards in Tasmania. The fairly premier ICT awards are the TAS ICT awards. They are one of the peak bodies of ICT in Tasmania. And I won, kind of unexpectedly, but I won the ICT Student of the Year in 2020, backed again the next year by the outstanding contribution of a woman in technology for an ongoing set of projects, which was really good. It was the first time I could really sit back and realize that this approach that I was taking, which was, to be fair, spitballing, I was trying different things to see which worked. When I actually found that what I was doing was actually making an impact, which was really good. And which is what all researchers want and SciComers want. So I worked with the Australian Computer Society and TAS-TAFE on a Women in ICT program. It was designed so that we could get a class that it was purely women, and there was justification for that, where there was purely women through its ICT course. And this is not to say that obviously courses should only be women. That's not what we mean. It is the fact that we just wanted to get a female-only class so that we can look at how they learn, what they learn, what they like, etc., in order to better design a class.
So why is it important to have an all-women sort of forum? Is that an unusual thing in the space of ICT?
It's very unusual for a couple of reasons. So one is that it's very unusual to have any women in an ICT class, which is it's just a common thing to have either have a male only or 99% male class. Obviously, we were trying to solve that. But what also happens is we notice that some women often feel like they are forced into being one of the boys. So this happens in all science fields. It's definitely not an ICT specific issue, but it is very much exacerbated by a field where they not only is communication a problem, but you've got ego communication and lack of communication, which is quite a strange thing to actually have to go up against. So often a lot of women find that they don't know where they fit at all. Was important to try and see, let's make a microcosm and see what actually comes out of this data-wise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's great. And so, yeah, so tell us more. How did you shape what you heard from this group of women into making something?
Absolutely. The first year was great. It was a bit small, but we just managed to be able to see that women thrived when they were able to give a lot of feedback and work collaboratively as a team, as a large team, as well as in small teams, of course. That obviously dovetailed with a lot of data on gender within science anyway. So which is really, really good. It was just good to confirm that. And then we actually had a larger intake for the second year. It was a two-year project. And what we were finding is that, and I made a model about this, which is part of what went into the awards. So what we found was that a lot of people, they'll do an ICT degree because it's quite technical. It is looking for one particular type of thing or just trying to get some ICT skills. They'll go out and they'll work. That's 100% how it goes. It's quite a technical field. Whereas what we were finding is the women were coming through and then they were graduating and then they were coming back for the second year as mentors. And that was the idea. We knew that that was starting to happen organically anyway, but watching it happen and then trying to guide that to happen, they actually jumped in and they were, we've got people now that are running their own smarts communication and their own coding clubs. And it's just, we've even had some on the show, for example, that started, went right through our program and are now running like the coding sisterhood, for example. So what they've done is they've created their own cyclical mentoring system. And so with that model, we've been able to predict the growth of bringing women, not just young women, because that's what we found that most people are dealing only with kids to bring them through. And that's great. We need that. What people are missing out on is the women coming back into the workforce or looking for jobs that they didn't think they could do. And these people need mentoring. And it's working really well. It's self-perpetuating. Oh,
that's so lovely. And yeah, big congratulations on those awards, because that would have been a lot of work. And just, it gives me the warm fuzzies hearing what a cyclical sort of pattern of mentoring and creating these communities. I mean, they're creating physical communities from what is often, you know, like you say, an online space is largely just online. So they're almost bringing that out into the community and making it more visible. And that's just amazing. And I wanted to go back to where you were talking about how, you know, women are kind of a minority in ICT, because I know that something that you're passionate about too is addressing the challenges that minorities face and bigotry and things, I guess, online and in the real world. So could you tell us a bit about that aspect of your work and your passion?
Absolutely. So I am very, very passionate about giving the underdog a voice, as I always say, whoever and whatever the underdog is. So whether it is allyship for LGBTQI+ communities, or whether we're talking about disability in technology, which is also something that's underrepresented women, it could be, basically, it can be a lot of different things. And I purposely, so bringing back to the Twitch channel, for example, I create a safe space. And by that, obviously, we know that online spaces are not safe. So it sounds like an oxymoron. But what I do is that I've got a very heavily moderated channel, moderated by people from minority groups. And so it's an open conversation. It always is. It's all based around science conversation, but bigotry isn't allowed. It's stamped on very quickly. Open voices are allowed. So if it's constructive and if it's non-judgmental, it's allowed. It's where a place where people can learn regardless of their background and who they are. And that was also for the Women in IT program as well. We made sure that it was open to everyone. It wasn't just open to minorities. They are a minority. So it was just, the idea here is I want to amplify voices from everyone. And this is not an anti-male establishment or an anti-white male establishment, as you hear in the Me Too movements and everything like that. I want people to be able to express their beliefs and their science together with no judgment.
Oh, that's amazing. And yeah, that's, I mean, it's just such important work. And like you say, you know, people often think of, and rightly so, the online space as a bit of a scary one that is unmoderated and there are no rules and anyone can kind of say what they want, which works really well sometimes and really terribly for minorities and people who are often the target of those sorts of attacks. So the fact that you've constructed this space is really amazing. And I'm sort of struck by the way that you structure it with the moderator. So how do you choose a moderator? What's a moderator's job in your Twitch streams?
So people who are familiar with Twitch know that it's got its own little subculture, which I've had to learn, which is really interesting, and then work out how to marry what I'm trying to do with the way Twitch operates. So yes, moderators are quite often people who will follow a streamer that seem to like what they do, like what they stand for, seem to be quite, it takes a while to choose a moderator because of the fact that they need to interact with you a little bit, interact with the community. You start to get to know them, but there is actually, apart from a few people, no one knows anyone's name. And this is the really interesting thing about this online community is you can be anonymous, and that's entirely fine. It's a relationship of the mind, with everybody. They just know what your channel stands for. They need to understand what I'm trying to create, and they need to be on board with that. And then what they do is they help me. So my job is already hard, talking, controlling the content and enticing people to talk at the same time as not looking at the chat constantly, which means that the mods have to be there to be able to stamp out any negative behavior or block any unfortunate bots that come in, or any problems that might happen in the chat. The mods are on top of it.
Wow, that is really incredible. And that's another thing where I feel like the idea of anonymity online often has negative connotations, because the idea of being anonymous is that you have no accountability for the bad stuff you say. But what this sort of situation does is flip that, right? Is that it's kind of, I guess it's protection too. Anonymity is also protection, and it also means that it can just be about the thoughts. It's not about who you are. It's not about, you know, your personal life. It's about having like a common cause that you will care about.
Exactly.
Gosh, that's amazing.
And on a student note, just to bring it back to the student note, that's part of how I get them to communicate, because the fear that they have with communicating is often the fact of the transparency that they have is sometimes negative to them. And by allowing them that shield, they will communicate more freely. And that's my experience.
Ah, that's amazing, Meredith. That's great. So join us for part three, the final part of our episode with Dr. Meredith Castles, where we talk about her research that she's been doing recently as she's just completed her PhD. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. And I'm here with my fellow TWIX member and today's lovely guest, Dr. Meredith Castles. And for the last part of the episode, we're going to talk about Meredith's PhD research, because as I said before, she's just finished it, which is very exciting, such a milestone. So Meredith, reflecting back, can you give us a snapshot? What was your PhD? And then we'll go into some more detail about what you did and what it means.
Thank you. So my plan at the moment is to sleep. sleep off the last 4 years.
Yes.
As you know. So what I did is, like everything else that I do, I looked around at a problem we have in ICT education. So I wanted to look at the human side of ICT education, because we have a bit of a disconnect. ICT as a field goes very fast. As most people know, when they look at Apple computers, by the time you're used to one, there's a new one out there. So same thing happens in all of ICT. Education is very hard to keep up with, because you need to stay relevant. And that's very hard to do when academics moves relatively slow and a field moves really, really fast. You often find problems that come out according to literature as well, but also that you can see as an educator, that students get a bit disengaged. They learn from other people more than they learn from the classes. That's what the feedback is. In order to make academics stay relevant is to do something a bit different. Academics needs to start looking at how they might engage students in a different way. And it seemed to sort of dovetail into what I was already doing in science communication, how I've managed to merge unorthodox areas before and go, what have I learned from that? And can I apply the same thing here? So how do I engage students and industry and ICT together? I actually applied a citizen science model.
So Meredith, citizen science is something that I'm somewhat familiar with, you know, in the biology space. This is a very, like you said, it's a very different space to you know, biology and places where you traditionally might think about citizen science being placed. So why did you choose it for your specific, very complex, multidisciplinary problem?
Absolutely. It is how to crowdsource data and analysis, crowdsource research. So you get people who are not necessarily experts in an area, but might have an interest in the area or a vested interest in the area, and they come together and more brains are better than one. Citizen social science is the same thing, but these are social phenomenon. If we're going to learn from technology, which is moving very fast, then we need to learn from people who are using that technology, which is often industry, students, and of course us as educators. So what was trying to be solved with this is it possible to be able to utilize a citizen science approach to be able to gather data to keep technology education relevant. And that is everybody learns from each other.
Oh, gosh, that's amazing. And the idea that, you know, as ICT and technology moves so quickly that, you know, laws and research just can't keep up. So you've got to have this constant feedback. I think that's a really relevant thing today. And a lot of people will be hearing that and thinking, yes, yes, that is something we need to do. So that's just, it's just amazing work that you're doing. And so you've spent all this time, you've spent, you know, a whole PhD researching this. So what's next, Meredith?
What's next is hopefully we can build this. The communication that was started just by the research process was so positive. Students that were jumping on this that were so excited that they could go, I find this really interesting, and being able to then influence curriculum from that is fantastic. Realizing that the work that they put into their education that could be seen as plagiarism or cheating, for example, if they're taking information from others or if they're learning from other people when they don't think that they should be, we're saying, do that, bring it in. We need to know. I mean, the more, again, it's a citizen science approach. More brains are better than one. A million brains are better than one curriculum designer. So essentially this is, you know, we've got our theory. We've got a theory. It should work. Now we're going to test it. So we'll have to build platforms. We'll have to be able to get proper feedback from those platforms. This is the design process of human-computer interaction. That is the next step.
Just amazing research. And I think that idea of this constant feedback through all the different channels back and forth is something that could be applied more broadly, honestly, than information technology. And I think it's a really innovative way that you've looked at doing your research. And it was a pleasure to talk to you and to have you talk about your research on the show. So thank you, Meredith.
Thank you, Kate.
So thanks for listening to That's What I Call Science. That's all we have time for today. And my name is Dr. Kate Johnson, and I'd like to again thank our guest for today, Dr. Meredith Castles. See you next time.
This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEMtastic.